You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says we can learn a lot about science from natural disasters, and that can help us be better prepared for future events.
First, the attack in New York City yesterday prompted President Trump to renew his calls for extreme vetting of immigrants. Yesterday afternoon, an Uzbek national allegedly drove a truck down a bike path in New York City, killing at least 8 people.
During a White House cabinet meeting today, the president said he's starting the process to end the diversity lottery system. He tweeted earlier today that the man allegedly responsible for the attack came into the U.S. as part of the diversity lottery program. In the wake of the attack, the president also tweeted that he wants to step up the extreme vetting program in immigration policy.
This morning in a news conference, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio answered a question about the president's request for immigrant vetting. He said the focus is on this particular incident and what can be done to respond. And when it came to vetting, he had this to say.
We support vetting of individuals. We support very thorough vetting, not of groups of people just because they belong to a group. I think this is a very crucial distinction. There should be very, very careful vetting of anyone where there's an indication of a concern, but not because of their religion or not because of their country of origin.
Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is an expert on immigration law, and she's the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Shobha, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back.
Let's start with the Diversity Lottery Program. What is it and how does it work?
Sure. I want to first express my condolences to the families of the victims of the latest attack, an act of mass violence, this time in downtown Manhattan, and express my own devastation by the attack. About the Diversity Lottery Program, this was enacted into law by Congress in 1990 with bipartisan support. And there is a section in the immigration statute called the Immigration and Nationality Act, which lays out this very intricate formula for which countries can benefit or participate in the Diversity Lottery Program. So natives of high admission countries are not eligible, but natives of all other countries qualify, with low admission regions getting a larger share. And so under the statute, if you are eligible to participate in the lottery, you would also have to show that you have a high school education or its equivalent, 2 years of experience in an occupation, which requires at least 2 years of training, and admissibility. And there are about 50,000 slots available each year. And just to contrast that to the number of immigrant visas allocated in other categories every year, this represents really just a drop in the bucket of the hundreds of thousands of immigrant visas that have been allocated in our immigration statute. And I'll end by saying that the goal and purpose of the Diversity Lottery Program is to ensure inclusivity. And so the legislative purpose and its practical impact, and I've seen it even in the classroom with individuals who are contributing to the academic experience and are recipients of the Diversity Lottery, that it really adds diversity to our society. And that's something we should all embrace.
What kind of political support is there and has there been for the Diversity Lottery Program?
Well, it has remained on the books since 1990, and I think there has been support. There have been some proposals to change the program or eliminate it, but historically those proposals have not been successful.
And then let's get to the vetting issue that we heard the president talking about since the attack and tweeting about, of course. He says we've got this extreme vetting program, we need more vetting. But what kind of background checks, what kind of looks do immigrants get, especially those who are on this, who came in via this diversity lottery program?
Sure. Well, it's pretty unclear unclear what the president means by extreme vetting. We already have extensive vetting procedures for people seeking admission into the United States. And with regard to the diversity lottery program, the winners undergo a vetting process that includes filling out necessary paperwork, filing an application, submitting photographs, having an in-person consular interview. And even after flying over to the United States and then arriving at a port of entry, there is a second opportunity that Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, has to ensure the individual is entering on the basis he or she claims to be, and then is inspected and admitted.
We're talking to Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia from Penn State University, looking at immigration policy after the president's comments following yesterday's terror attack in New York City. Shobha, in the timeline of the alleged perpetrator here, this is someone who apparently came over to the country from Uzbekistan about 7 years ago. Now, passed all of these checks, people, and this is one of those cases where details are still unclear. The story may change as we continue to follow it. I want to say that, but was, as people say, radicalized somewhere between now and them. Is there some kind of follow-up check over the course of years after someone is admitted into the United States?
So if the individual has an encounter with the immigration agency, perhaps at the time of applying for citizenship, that would be another check that the agency would have after someone has acquired a green card, which this person seems to have done. But you raise an important point, and that is, you know, what is the precipitous for this individual's actions? And is the solution enhanced extreme vetting as a general matter, or sweeping restrictions against people based on where they're from or their religion? I think the short answer to that question is no. There's no such thing as perfect screening, but the process we do have in place is strong. We still need more information, but if this is somebody who was radicalized after entering the United States, then this really is unrelated to extreme vetting and demands a solution that is narrowly tailored to fighting violence and anti-terrorism.
As a matter of policy, is it hard to make a smaller change, a tweak like that, in the background of this ongoing years, now I guess decades-long debate over overall immigration reform? Is it hard to make a small change to our immigration system now with all this in the backdrop?
Well, immigration has never been an easy question, and the law itself has been compared second in complication to the U.S. tax code. You know, on the affirmative or reform front, I'd support and love to see a Clean Dream Act pass the U.S. Congress by the end of the year, because what is also in the backdrop for me is the end of a very successful program known as DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and the need for a permanent solution for people who are contributing in such extraordinary and significant ways. Does the individual who was radicalized and perpetrated this devastating attack in Manhattan cloud that conversation? Absolutely. But I certainly don't think the answer is to be reactive or overreactive and to gut a well-functioning program that was created on a bipartisan basis, or to create vetting programs that may not even be legal. We've seen at least three different types of restrictions that have been signed by the president and later blocked by courts on constitutional or statutory grounds. And so underpinning all of these questions is also whether or not there is a legal basis.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia. She's an expert on immigration law at Penn State University, also founder and director of the Center for Immigrants Rights Clinic. She joined us to talk about the president's stances on immigration after yesterday's attack in New York City.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
It's hunting season in Wisconsin. For Bruce Stewart, the lure of the hunt isn't necessarily the birds he might get, but the time in the woods and the connection with his heritage.
Despite coming to this Oneida County lake for 52 years, I can still drive 10 minutes to a forest road I've never walked before. Like deer, we seldom stray far from our habitual paths. I back the truck off the road, uncase my gun, and put 3 shells in for the partridge hunt. The fall equinox has passed, and the leaves have gone their golden red ways. Dad and I, and sometimes Mom, would walk similar logging roads falls ago. The memories layered in my mind like detritus. The more recent, crisp, fresh, the older, moldy, dark, transforming into the humus that sustains the roots of my being. Before I was old enough to carry a gun, I carried a stick, and Dad instructed me on keeping the gun pointed in a safe direction at all times. When I was ready, I got to carry my BB gun, then an unloaded shotgun, then a loaded shotgun, all the while steeped in the ways of partridge. That they picked stones for their gizzard along the road in first light. That they relished wintergreen leaves and berries in alder thickets along the creek. That in the afternoon on gusty November days, they favored a sunny southern slope beneath the hazel brush. Without a dog, we needed to creep stealthily, watching, listening, even smelling. After several flushes, the brain begins to associate a partridge's explosive burst with the smell of those places. Maybe it's dampened aspen leaves. Maybe it's fir needles and sphagnum. Maybe it's sun-roasted pine needles. You become your own dog, more closely attuned to the world. We interspersed our slow walk with frequent pauses. During pauses, we'd ready, because if a bird is near, it'll get nervous, cluck a few times, and take off. Or it will wait for the first step you take after pausing. Or the next step. You never know. The trail curves, dividing a red pine stand from an aspen copse. The pines shelter the copse, under which grow blackberry brambles, wine red, and a soft bed of dwarf dogwood and sedge, still green. Partridge pops through the bramble. Too fast, too far. I never get the safety off. The trail descends, and 10 yards to my left, another whir of wings and gone. So close, yet cloaked by the hazel brush. The trail fades at the bottom of a bowl. A final bird rises above the hazel straight away. I take the easiest shot in the book and miss. Sitting on a fallen log, I smoke half and half tobacco in a corncob pipe in honor of Dad. Like the red squirrel dismembering a pine cone a few feet away, I tackle a celebratory Cortland. I look down at my Uncle Al's hunting coat, tattered, faded corduroy and duck's back. I think of the swamps and meadow edges, frozen rain and lingering autumnal sun that it's absorbed. Across my lap, Dad's Model 12, the varnish on the walnut grip worn by the friction and sweat of his palm. Someday the jacket will be unwearable. Someday the gun could be in a landfill. Even so, they outlasted their original owners. Or did they? In the stillness, I feel them, streaming through my blood.
Bruce Stewart is a teacher in Baraboo. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now it's been a rough couple of months in the United States when it comes to natural disasters. From a string of hurricanes in the southeast to massive wildfires in the western parts of the country.
Our next guest is teaching a class on the science behind natural disasters, but he didn't know the topic would be quite so urgent when the semester started. Harold Tobin is a professor of geosciences at UW-Madison. Harold, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, what led you to teach a course on the science of disasters?
Well, I've been wanting to teach this course actually for a long time. And really, it's because, you know, everybody hears about natural disasters. They're in the news all the time, whether it's hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and other things. And it's an opportunity for us to actually get people an introduction to some of the science behind them. They're all Earth events, and we teach geology and we teach geophysics. So it's a chance to get a lot of students who maybe aren't really science students to just think a little bit about how the planet affects, you know, human society.
And that's got to make students really focus in, because this is not an abstract science. This is something with very real-world implications.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. You know, if I'm talking about hurricanes, which is the way I started the semester off this year, for example, we had them in the news every single day. People were seeing everything from weather forecast, radar maps, you know, predictions of the track of the hurricane coming. And we could use that as a way in the course to get people's interest up and then talk about the physics of the atmosphere or questions about the science of how they form and why they form and why one grows up to be a Category 5 hurricane, but others dissipate into a smaller tropical storm. Those are the kinds of questions I wanted students to really focus on. And there's no question that's what was in the news really got people interested.
Well, give us a little taste of something that maybe surprises your students about hurricanes, something we might not know.
Yeah, well, one of the things that surprises them, I think, ultimately, is that hurricanes really are just gigantic heat engines, right? They're driven by the warmth of the ocean surface and the way the ocean and the atmosphere exchange heat. So that's pretty cool. But that teaches the students why the path of the hurricanes time and time again, you know, starts in the central Atlantic Ocean, down through the Caribbean, then takes this curving right-hand turn, kind of hook-shaped arc over and over and over again. Tie the physics of the hurricane to the Coriolis force, and voila, you see why the tracks year after year are almost the same.
Our planet is kind of built in part to make hurricanes, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely right. They come out directly from the rotation of the Earth and the way the atmosphere and seasons, the atmosphere and the ocean interact with each other. And that's true of all sorts of natural disasters. Our planet is built to make earthquakes and to make tsunamis or landslides, any of those things.
And speaking of earthquakes, now your students are seeing real-world disasters going on as they're learning about them. This happened in your career, too. You were right on top of just about a big earthquake, and that was a formative moment in your career as a scientist.
Yeah, that's correct. I just started graduate school literally 3 weeks before the 1989, the one they call the World Series earthquake, mm-hmm. right? We call it the Loma Prieta earthquake in California. And I was in graduate school at University of California in Santa Cruz. We were right on top of that earthquake. I was already interested in geology and earth science, but that's the event that really made me focus my PhD work and ultimately my whole career on active processes. So a lot of geologists study, you know, things that happened a long time ago. And it's interesting to talk about 65 million years ago and the dinosaurs or something. But for me, it's about what's going on today, right here and now, which, you know, plate tectonics is affecting our lives now, not just in the past.
Something that surprised me about plate tectonics is what a recent discovery that was. This, we were just pinning this down, you know, within a lot of people who are listening's lifetimes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely right. Within my lifetime, you know, that we went from no theory at all of plate tectonics to it being the accepted understanding of how the Earth works. I was fortunate enough to have some of my own professors be some of the people who had really, you know, pioneered those ideas. It's recent, and we're still just beginning, I think, to understand all the ramifications for how the biggest scale of how the planet works affects the smallest scale of daily lives in the form of, let's say, things like tsunamis and earthquakes.
We're talking to Harold Tobin, professor of geoscience at UW-Madison, about his course going on now, very timely, on disasters and the science behind them. The other big disaster I'm sure you and your students were following were, well, disasters, plural, wildfires up and down the west coast of the United States, among others. Tell us a little bit about the science of wildfires.
Yeah, well, you know, wildfires are a very interesting case because while they're certainly a natural disaster, air quotes, mm-hmm. They are also really the conditions for wildfire in the West has been fueled by human activities, and not just the most recent ones, but actually ones going back a century or more. I mean, certainly one of the reasons why the wildfires are so devastating is that there are a lot more people building in the way, right? There are houses, and suburban sprawl in the U.S. has led to a lot of construction in areas that used to be sort of natural areas and are around. People like to live out in the forest. But even beyond that, going back all the way through the 20th century, you know, we've had a policy in the U.S. of suppressing wildfire. That's added fuel. Okay, so there's a lot more that can burn. And then the recent California droughts really set the conditions up for there to be a lot of burnable material. All of that over these different kind of timescales finally combined with a real weather event where extremely strong gusty winds led to, you know, a few trigger points that had started fires for whatever reason turning into these conflagrations that just burned through Santa Rosa and other communities and had that devastating impact really in the course of just a few hours, in fact.
And you put natural in air quotes when you talk about wildfires as a natural disaster. To some extent, that is true, you say, of all disasters. It's an intersection between the natural part and a lot of human decision-making and policies and history.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we call the course Natural Hazards and Disasters. And in a way, it's natural hazards, which are real and part of the planet and will always be there and have always been there. But the disaster part is when, you know, human beings or their property gets in the way, right? So an earthquake could happen in a remote part of the ocean, and it might be even a large earthquake, but, you know, you don't hear about it in the news because maybe it doesn't do any damage. Similarly, a hurricane that affects an unpopulated area. But there are more and more people on the planet all the time, and we build more and more stuff. So that's really, you know, the cause of the increasing, you know, frequency and scale of the disasters that come from them. Sometimes we like to say, you know, earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do. Because that's right. If you're out in the middle of an open field during an earthquake, it's not a scary event particularly. But if a building is potentially going to come down on your head, that's a different story. And the same goes for floods and a lot of other different kinds of disasters.
Is this a mode of thinking you're hoping more people take on, not just to view natural disasters as this random event, we couldn't have done anything about it, but to think, what can we do to prepare for the next one, to be resilient as we bounce back from it?
Yeah, resilient is a great term for that. And of course, it's become really a buzzword. Mm-hmm. There's no question that natural hazards abound and they're out there. And some of them are probably even being made worse by some of the long-term effects of things like climate change. Others, maybe ones that come from the deep earth, like a volcanic eruption or an earthquake, are not really affected by human activity. But the response and the damage they create is something that's really in our control. So the biggest message to the public is, you know, be prepared. Don't be afraid of natural disasters. In Wisconsin, we can have floods, we can have blizzards, tornadoes. In California, you know, it might be different hazards, but everybody can be prepared, make sure that their house is well prepared, make sure they're ready for an emergency, for having the power out, all of those kinds of things that are steps each person as an individual can take, and it kind of empowers us to feel resilient.
It's a good place to leave it. Harold, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Harold Tobin, professor of geoscience at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the class he's teaching on the science behind natural disasters. Now, Veronica has done many amazing interviews here on Wisconsin Public Radio on, to the best of our knowledge, the Veronica Rickert Show, and of course here on Central Time. On her last day here at WPR, we wanted to revisit one of her most powerful and memorable interviews.
For a person living with a disability, accomplishing what can seem like a small task can be very time-consuming. Meeting a work deadline or going out with friends to grab a quick bite to eat, these things might not always be doable.
Ellen Samuels has a rare genetic disease. She recently wrote about her struggles in Disability Studies Quarterly. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison and the author of Fantasies of Identification, Disability, Gender, Race. She joined us in September.
Your essay talks about living life in what you call crip time. Can you explain in your own words what is crip time?
Well, crip time is kind of an in-group expression that some disabled people use amongst ourselves. And originally it just meant being late. When you're disabled, there's a lot of reasons that you might be late, right? But in recent years, some of us have been talking about it more as this sense of when time becomes flexible, when time becomes what your body needs or what your mind needs instead of the time that the outside world tells you to have. And my friend Allison Kafer in her wonderful book, Feminist Queer Crip, says queer crip time is flex time, not just expanded, but exploded.
And you write that it can be, on the one hand, this beautiful thing and about giving your body the space, sort of for time to bend around what your body needs, but on the other hand, something that also holds grief and loss and alienation, all these things within it.
Yes, absolutely. That was what I wrote about in this essay. As I said, I'm going to take a moment and talk about crip time in a different way than we've been talking about it, and talk about the ways it involves loss and brokenness. And that's not to contradict the ways that it's beautiful and forgiving, but that we have to hold both.
Can you tell us a little bit about what living your life, since it sounds like your 20s in what you call crip time, what it meant for you?
Well, I was in my 20s when I started to not be able to do the things other people my age could do. First, I couldn't use my hands. Then I couldn't walk. Then I was just very sick and in pain and losing weight, and no one knew why. And it took a long time after that. It took almost 15 years for them to discover that I had this rare genetic disorder called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And really, I'd had it my whole life, but it was in my 20s that it began to really disrupt my life. And at that point, I felt that I moved out of the time of my peers and into a new time, a time when I often felt I had more in common with people in their 70s or 80s who were struggling to hold on to their independence, who were struggling with fatigue and pain the way that I was.
And you write really openly, really honestly about how you feel. And there's a story you tell about swimming in the warm water pool with some of these people who are in their 70s and their 80s. And at one point you say, really frankly, I hate them. Can you tell us what's going through your mind then?
I thought you might ask about that. That's probably the moment I was most nervous about publishing in this essay, when I said, you know, I go to the pool, in the warm water pool. Everyone else is much older than me. They frequently ask me, why are you here? What's wrong with you? And I tell them, and then they tell me about their lives. And I don't often admit this, but I hate them because they want me to be sympathetic about what they've lost. But what they've lost is what I lost decades and decades before, and they don't see it. And that, I say, is the privilege of not living in crip time. You've had a life of normal time. You've had a life of the stages we expect people to have, and I didn't have that. And I'll tell you, of all the, and this essay has had, I've been so touched by the response it's gotten. I did not expect it to get such a wide and public response. And people, strangers, are writing to me from all over the country. And that's the number one thing that they say, is they say, thank you, I hate them too, in some context or another.
So it's opening a conversation, it sounds like, that hasn't been said before. I've never heard people write like this before. We've interviewed many guests on this program, and no one has spoken quite, you know, in that raw, this is exactly what I'm feeling, this is my experience, and I'm just going to say it. Do you think that's opened some doors for honest conversations in a sense that we haven't had before, ever, maybe?
I think every time someone tells a truth that hasn't been told before, they find out that there's thousands of other people holding that same truth. And that's absolutely what's happened with this essay for me.
And in your essay, you take us back to the summer of 1995, when your medical, your genetic disease took a turn for the worse. Can you tell us a little bit about your disability and how you live day to day now?
Absolutely. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a connective tissue disorder. It's caused by a defect in collagen, which is one of the main proteins that builds our bodies. And so it's in every system. So it affects every system. I often describe it as everything's too loose, everything's too weak. It's like a push puppet, if you know what those are, those dolls, and their joints are held together by string, and you push the bottom and they collapse. So my joints are like that. They're what medically it's called hypermobility. And so my body is working so hard all day to keep me together. Even when I'm just sitting here talking to you, my body is putting out the energy that a regular person's body puts out to run a marathon. And as a result, I get the injuries that athletes get. I get the injuries wrestlers get. I get the injuries that gymnasts get, but I get them just from turning over in bed.
We're talking right now with Ellen Samuels, an associate professor of gender and women's studies at UW-Madison. She's talking about her essay that describes how people with disabilities often accomplish tasks at a very different speed and experience the world around them very differently. And it's something that she and others call crip time. And Ellen, in your piece, you describe how you decided to pursue academia as a career. You thought, well, maybe I can't really work a 9-to-5 job like maybe I thought I could, so I'm going to go back to school, pursue a life as an academic. And you describe lying under the desks during the lectures to get through them, but also finding there, I mean, some joy and happiness at what you were doing, even though you say you were alone. Is that an example of what you've had to do to say, you know what, this is what my body needs, so this is what I'm going to do?
Right. It's really quite astonishing when you think about the wide range of people's abilities and needs that were so wedded to the 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week schedule. And being in my 20s, I couldn't do those jobs anymore. I couldn't do things like waitressing, which is what I'd done to get through high school. And I thought, what can I do? I can read and I can write and I can teach people. about reading and writing. I know how to do that. And when I went back to graduate school to do that, I discovered that even though I was still so different from my peers, I was still in a very different time from them, it was a time that I could make work. If I needed to write all night and sleep all day, I could do that.
And looking at the concept of time, I think that's one thing that really comes out into stark relief is the way, you know, time for someone who might not be struggling with a disability unfolds in this very linear way in general. And the body goes through predictable stages, as you said, getting to 70, 80 and starting to lose some of that mobility. And you've had to experience some of that sooner. And it's made you think about how you wish there were alternate versions of time. You wish you could kind of switch, like code switch back between different loops of time and experience things. In general, has it changed the way that you think about time and how it functions in your own life?
Thank you for that question. I think about this all the time. I didn't mean that as a pun, but I think about it every day when I I'm going through my day and I'm organizing it differently from other people. I work for an hour and I rest for an hour. Or maybe I work for an hour and I rest for the rest of the day. And I constantly have voices in my head saying, "You're wasting time." And then I have another voice that says, "No, this is my time. I'm living on Crip time."
Do you think that time, as we think of it, has to, in a mainstream sense, for someone without a disability, do you think it has to unfold that way? Our society has to be structured that way? Or would there be a way to make it more flexible? Not just for you, but for everybody. Is there a way to be more like time sensitive? It's not a concept I've ever thought of before until I read your piece, but is there a way to make time a little more bendy to accommodate people?
There are already so many efforts to do that, I would say. I mean, just the concept of flex time, which we often think of as accommodating parents, but it just accommodates people with different kinds of bodies, different kind of minds, different ways that they care for themselves and care for others. And I think we need so much more of that. And I think the resistance to it is not a rational resistance, because I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think there's a lot of research showing flex time increases productivity and it increases morale. And, you know, recently I was listening to NPR and hearing about, you know, another study showing that teenagers do better if their school starts later, and yet no one is having their school start later. And it's because we have this weird morality about time. We think you have to work certain times in certain ways to be a good person or to be a productive person. But any of us can look around in our lives and see that's not true.
We're revisiting an interview from earlier this year with Ellen Samuels. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies in English at UW-Madison. She's telling us about how people with disabilities often accomplish tasks at a very different speed than the world around them. She calls it Crip time.
Can you identify with Ellen's story? Are you living with a disability? Do you set aside more time to accomplish tasks through your day? Love to hear your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. How has your workplace responded to your disability? How about family? How about friends? Do they understand what it takes to just be you? Again, post your thoughts and insights on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll be back with the second half of our conversation with Ellen Samuels in a little bit. Stay with us on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're revisiting a conversation about living with a disability and the extra time and energy it takes to live in a world that is skewed toward people without disabilities. Ellen Samuels wrote an essay in Disability Studies Quarterly about this. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies in English at UW-Madison.
You can join in to talk about your experiences living with a disability on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you relate to what Ellen says about what she calls Crip time? What advice do you have for people who don't live with a disability to help them better understand what you go through every day? Share your thoughts and experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Ellen, you've written this essay, which you've gotten this tremendous response to. You are a writer, and now it sounds like you also have an outlet through poetry. And I know you brought us a few poems in for us. Could you read a few and share those?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. So in the past year, I've been quite ill, and I've been spending a lot of time in medical testing, treatments, procedures. It has not left me the time to do the kind of intensive research writing I often do. So instead, I've started writing poetry in my head. I've been writing poetry for decades now, but these new poems, they're very short, and I actually write them in my head while I'm having medical procedures. And I have almost a whole book of them now. It's called Immobilities, and I'll just read three from that. Oh, I'll explain. A joint subluxation is when a joint partially dislocates and goes back in.
Okay.
The difference between joint subluxation and dislocation. Door unlatched in the body house. Shutter to slow kiss the jam or slam. Hmm. This next one is, I often injure myself while I'm asleep, and that's what this is about. Ankle sprain while sleeping. Warm swell of pain, foot knuckle bruising. What dance did you dream and forget? And the last one is about genetic testing for the genetic defect I have that causes Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Genetic testing for the COL5A1 mutation. One letter typed wrong. One plate chipped. Blood deep in you. One petal drifting.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing those. Those are beautiful, and it also gives me a window, like the essay does, into what you're thinking and what life is like. Thinking about the dream dances that might injure a foot is something that you might not realize, and you've got it in poetry form there. And I want to take a caller now on this conversation. We've got Mark joining us in Green Bay. Mark, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What do you want to share?
Well, I just wanted to ask your guest. The first time I guess I've really heard this topic discussed under this framework. I too have a chronic disability for many, many years, since I think 1995. Your guest said she was first diagnosed, and a lot of chronic fatigue and a lot of I've never used this word crip time, I guess, but it's certainly rings true with my personal experience. One of the more large issues that I've dealt with is how to deal with the frustration and explaining that crip time to the outside world, because oftentimes, understandably so, people just don't relate with that concept. They see it as excuses, or in my case, I look relatively healthy, but there's some obvious physical disability if they're observant enough. And certainly a lot of chronic fatigue, they come along that require you to kind of, frame your daily life around that, work life, personal life, things of this nature. Just wonder if she had any comments about that.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you calling up and sharing what your experience is, too. And Ellen, what advice do you have for Mark? He wants to know how to explain his sense of time, what you call crip time, to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I really appreciate you asking this question, Mark. It's such a struggle for me and for so many of us with chronic illnesses, especially when they're not really apparent or visible. I have two suggestions. If it's someone in your life who you know who's willing to put in a little bit of time and thought, there's this wonderful essay called The Spoon Theory, by a woman named Christine Miserando. And if you just Google the spoon theory, it will come up, that talks about living with chronic illness as having only so many spoons. And once you run out of spoons, you're done for the day. And healthy people might have 20 spoons, but we only have 5. And maybe just showering and getting dressed and eating takes 3 of our spoons. If it's someone you don't know as well, someone who's not going to read this and start understanding it in that way, then I would say, don't make excuses. Don't apologize. Just say, this is what I can do and can't do. And some people will accept it. Some people will ask more, and you can tell them about your experience. And some people won't. And I think one of the hardest lessons for us to learn is that's their problem. It's not ours.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for calling, and I hope that helps. And Ellen, do you see a future as you start to talk openly about this? Mark joins the conversation. More conversations start happening at a national level, where what you call crip time is something that is understood, first of all, by everybody, and is made so you're not just the one flexing around the time, but other people are helping you.
I do. I am optimistic. I think there's still a lot of change that needs to be made and a lot of struggles, but I think it's something that joins us with other people, with working parents. I look at my students today and they give me so much optimism for the future. They're facing a difficult future, much more difficult than I faced at their age or than my parents faced. And they're so generous and hopeful and hardworking and sensitive to these issues. And so it does give me a lot of hope.
We had that conversation with Ellen Samuels earlier this year. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison. She wrote an essay in Disability Studies Quarterly about getting by in a world designed for people without disabilities.
That was one of the many great interviews that Veronica has done over the years here at Central Time and all of her other duties here at Wisconsin Public Radio. But this is it. This is the last day, and Judith Sears Poisson is in the studio to help say goodbye.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure to tell Veronica, not just personally, but share with our audience what a real privilege and pleasure it's been to work with you on Central Time, of course, for these last couple of years, but also before that, hearing you do really incredible interviews. And, you know, you have a talent for connecting with people on a really human level that really is extraordinary. And we've all really been privileged to be able to listen in on those conversations.
You can't make me cry, Judith.
Oh, we're gonna make you cry.
Well, now.
There's no option. And yeah, and you were, I worked with you for my, I've said this on the air before, for my first day here at Wisconsin Public Radio in the Tom Clark producer's
yeah,
team.
Back in the Stone Age.
Office. Yeah, you were, you did music hosting then, and you were part-time with Tom, and you've done all of the stuff here. You were
all
trying to come up
stuff.
With shows you haven't worked on, and they're few and far between.
That's true. I've been around for a while. Well, thank you for the kind words. It's been my privilege to be here and to sit side by side with Wisconsin and all the people listening. I really feel like they are friends, and there's a community there. We say, we use that word lightly, but there really is a community.
Well, and I just want to say that you and Rob pitched the idea of Central Time, which wasn't quite what it ended up being, but, you know,
true.
Central Time is on the air. We are all here listening, working on the show, being part of that community, thanks to the foresight that you two had, and of course, people who make decisions at WPR. So I just wanted to make sure people realize that what they enjoy about Central Time is in large part because of the idea that you and Rob had and brought to fruition.
And the initial idea for the show was me and you on the air together talking. We didn't really have, I mean, that was before.
Isn't that Seinfeld?
Not content, not format, nothing. That was the initial idea. So it wouldn't have, it'll be really different and weird without you, because that was the whole thing of the show. We're going to try to keep something going here. I think hopefully it'll be good.
I could call in during the show and razz you.
That's true.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, we will make sure we know what your new phone number is.
So block me.
But seriously, from all of us here at WPR, the Central Time team, and for all the listeners, I just wanted to say thank you for everything and, you know, best of luck. And not that you need it, but best of luck in your new adventures.
Thank you. And I have to give a shout out to the team, because the Central Time team is incredible. And I don't say that lightly. The team is incredible. Michelle Good, our technical director, Rob, of course, my buddy, Judith, you've been guiding us with such with insight and
thank you.
Precision. And it's been fabulous having you on board, because we didn't always have someone in your role. And we had Cheryl Gasser in the early days. It was lovely to have her direct us. Halima Shah, J. Carlisle Larson, Amanda Magnus, Dean Knetter, our call screener back there. So grateful. So grateful. Chris Molina in the early days, too. Lots of great, talented, smart, and really caring, compassionate, insightful folks I've been privileged to work with.
Well, and Veronica, you just bring such skill and talent, but also passion to what you do. And you've really helped all of us remember that it is about the listeners out there. And what are we bringing to the listeners that we're not working in this little bubble here? And so that's something that your influence on will definitely continue on Central Time. And we will try to make you proud.
Thank you so much. And something to look forward to, Judith, coming up tomorrow on Central Time. A guest makes the case that the American political system should rely less on experts and more on citizens.
A guest shares research on how to get more people of color to go into science and technology field. She says one key, it's not just the money, it's about helping communities.
And a Wisconsin reporter takes us on a tour of the brandy old fashioned.
That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.